Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone. Are you listening to the FlixWise podcast on a vintage tube radio in an empty, smoke-filled room while wearing some form-fitting, breath-inhibiting clothing? If not, well, then you're doing it wrong. But thanks for listening anyway. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P, or the Drunken Master, for that matter. And giving me amorous and fervent stares from across the room is FlixWise's art director and frequent guest, Emma Garrard.
Hey, Pauline. Have you eaten?
Hello, Pauline.
Not doing that.
And joining us today is a man who's always leaving his hat where it doesn't belong, Kevin McKee.
Hello, Lady P. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
When Kevin isn't at the track, he's producing his own podcast called Guilty Film, and we're very, very happy to have him on our show. Today's Sight and Sound entry is the first one that was released in the 21st century, Wong Kar-wai's In the Mood for Love. Because the film came out in 2000, in the year 2000.
In the year 2000. 2000.
The critical community hasn't had as long a time to assess the work, but that didn't stop them from making it the 24th greatest movie on the critics' poll. Will our little panel agree with that assertion? Kiss us, kiss us, kiss us. Then, we're going to talk about a subject in which Kevin is well-versed, guilty pleasures. As I mentioned, Kevin is the host of Guilty Film Podcast, where each week he and his fellow podcasters evaluate a debatably classic movie selection. Examples include Gremlins 2, Xanadu, Hackers, and Sister Act. We're going to talk to Kevin about why he decided to make a podcast about what some might consider schlocky or even bad movies? Bad? Question mark? Finally, we're going to wrap things up with a few final notes of positivity. All right. You guys in the mood to podcast?
Absolutely.
I'm not sure.
Well, we're going to do it anyway. First up, we're going to revel in some sultry, perfectly manicured repression. It's the 24th greatest movie of all time, In the Mood for Love, a film in which director Wong Kar-wai aims to prove once and for all that the only thing sexier than sex is no sex at all. In the Mood for Love is a period drama set primarily in 1962 Hong Kong. It tells the story of a pair of neighbors whose spouses are having an affair with each other. Upon discovering their partner's infidelity, our protagonists, Suthi Jin, or Mrs. Chen, played by Maggie Cheung, and Chow Mo-wan, played by Tony Leung, take comfort in each other by imagining and acting out the ways that they think the dalliance began, and by rehearsing the inevitable confrontation that both of them must have with their significant others. Throughout the course of the film, Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan's emotional connection becomes increasingly apparent. The pair share glances that linger a little too long, and there are brushes of each other's extremities that are full of portent and longing. However, the pair remain resolute to never commit the sins of their better halves. Their love story goes unfulfilled. By the end, our protagonists part ways without ever having acted on their obvious attraction. While the movie is undoubtedly romantic, the film is ultimately about how the characters let opportunities slip through their fingers and how timidity and propriety can stand in the way of happiness. At least that's what I think it's about. All right, so do you like the movie? Emma, let's start with you.
Yes, I liked the movie.
Okay, what'd you like about it?
Well, first of all, it's extra pretty.
It sure is. That's what I wanted. This, like, so most period pieces that are set in the early 60s are, usually an aesthete's daydream. Like, that's just generally across the board. And I think Emma will agree, there's some pretty great wallpaper in this movie.
I love wallpaper in movies. I almost can't believe it isn't a horror movie with the wallpaper that's in room 2046.
Yes.
In that. I really like the costumes. Mm-hmm. I was really interested in, like, the history of Chung Sam's for a while. And I don't usually research the production of the movies when we do the podcast, but I did have to look up this one, and I read that Maggie Cheung could not figure out how to move in them, and it prolonged the shooting partially.
Just sort of confining, yeah. Mm-hmm. Kevin, what'd you think?
Are you on the edge of your seats?
Yes.
I loved it.
Okay, good.
It was a phenomenal film. It's a rare movie that I think approaches every element of filmmaking with equal importance. And it succeeds with almost everyone. A movie that more or less doesn't waste a single scene. So it completely has trimmed the fat away. So this is a nice and tight hour, 38-minute movie. I have a feeling that most of the other movies on Sight and Sound's list are much longer than this.
It varies.
And I think it has a lot of compelling themes about morality and relationships and the passing of time and lost opportunity. And yet it's very ambiguous about it. So it leaves you thinking, and there are not many movies that get me thinking like this movie did.
Absolutely. So what did you make of the relationship between Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan?
Well, for one, it was easy to believe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't seem like a lot of romance movies. I can't believe at all, but this seemed like something.
Why did you believe this one more over some of the other ones? What are some examples of ones you didn't believe or you don't believe?
Ones I don't believe? Like any romantic comedy. Like, it's often sometimes, like, I feel like this movie could have been, like, this guy, like, stalking her romantically and then winning her away from her husband or something like that.
Right, yeah.
But I think most people can relate to having some person in their life where it just never worked out for whatever reason.
Right, right. Kevin, how about you?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I like how it slowly develops through chance encounters. So it is, like Emma was saying, very real in that regard. And then the way that they deal with their internalized grief by reenacting how they think their spouses began the cheating process is fascinating. I never would have thought about anybody doing that kind of thing, but it's an interesting way to deal with that shock to your system. So the platonic relationship is kind of played out like a parallel to the infidelity of their spouses, which I thought was interesting too. And then, of course, the scene where they eat a meal together is kind of like a sexual episode, which is interesting as well.
Exactly. Like, I love how Wong Kar-wai uses food in all of his movies. It's like, it's always very sensual. Like, people who share food, it's always very intimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Em and I were watching Happy Together, which is another film of his, and I thought about there's a scene where one of the people in the relationship makes the other food, and then the other, instead of joining him for a meal, instigates a huge fight.
Mm-hmm.
The sharing of food is very, very significant and prevalent in his work, which mm-hmm. I love. But for this relationship, what I loved about it is that they seem to be bonding over their mutual just desire for their mutual kindness and politeness, and they both seem to desire to want to do the right thing. And when their spouses cheat on them, it becomes unclear what that right thing is. But I think it's sort of they both want to be really unobtrusive. They both seem to want to just disappear in some ways and not make a spectacle. And ultimately, I think that stands in the way of their happiness. So, I mean, they're both shy, sort of. I don't know if you'd agree with that. If it's shyness or, like, just unobtrusiveness, like, even just knocking on the door feels like each other's doors feels like an event. Like,
yeah,
that seems so fraught.
There's definitely, like, a lot going on about, like, visibility and, like, being known in the movie. Like, they live in a really, like, tight-knit little building, but we don't see their spouses the whole movie. And, like, we get the feeling that they both, like, kind of feel invisible and unloved in their relationships. But at the same time, like, their neighbors are always sitting there playing mahjong and gossiping about everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the weight of preserving the honor and the morality of the culture, I think, weighs so heavily on them that even when they're doing things that are innocent, like having a meal or meeting on the street or something like that, in their minds, and I mean, you don't know what's going on in their minds, but at the same time, you know what they're thinking is much more than what's going on visually.
Right.
So
right.
I think that they felt, and you could kind of tell that they felt like they were doing something wrong through these innocent acts.
Right. Yeah. That's interesting. Are they trying to preserve morality in the larger sense, or is it just for their own sakes? Is it like, I know there's a line where Mrs. Chan says something like, "We won't be like them." I always took it to mean like, we don't want to be like our spouses, but all of the tertiary characters in this movie seem in some ways to be if not immoral, then sort of lax, morally lax, or just, you know, gossips. Or I mean, there aren't a lot of virtuous people in this movie. There's Ping, there's the spazzes, there are the nosy neighbors, there's the drunken neighbors, there are the gamblers, and then it's Mr. Chow and Mrs. Chan is like the soul, the pillars of virtue. Or at least that seems to be how they want to see themselves. But I'm wondering, do you guys think they feel beholden to the society at large, or is this more like a personal struggle for them?
Like, is it less about being moral and less more about being like, when you're in love, you want to feel like you're special and you're not like the other people you see in the world, just right. going about their lives?
Exactly. Yeah. 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 Does the fact that they're not sleeping together lend their romance greater gravitas, or or are they, is there?
Well, definitely makes the movie more interesting.
It sure does.
So.
I think it's a little bit of both, actually.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, they want to conform to, you know, the society at large. And at the same time, they have this internalized vision of themselves as uncorrupted, and they don't want to become like their spouses. They don't want to hate themselves like that. And I think they've come to a place in their loneliness, because they've both been alone for so long, that they've you know, convinced themselves that we are good people and we can't stray
right.
from that, because right. that's all we have.
Right. And it's interesting, we never see the spouses, or we see the backs of their heads or whatever. For me, that serves to... they become more like spectral presences more than actual humans. And I think that serves as just, we aren't meant to root for them. I think we are never meant to root for them to stay with their spouses, right?
Sure.
And I think that's largely because we never see them. Mm-hmm. And they're just meant to be kind of just more of like just another force controlling them and keeping them apart, more so than any actual relationship. Do you think what do you think it would have been like had we seen the spouses?
Like, the spouses wouldn't have to have been around very much. Like, if we saw them at all, like, it would automatically be about picking between two people
right.
instead of about their own relationship. Like, you don't have to show somebody a lot to, like, give the impression that they're sympathetic, you know?
Right, exactly, yeah.
But I don't think we're even supposed to really think about them at all.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that. It would have taken the focus off of our protagonist. And, I mean, at its core, I don't think it's a movie about why bad people do the things they do. It's a movie about why good people do the things they do.
Right,
So, you know, let's focus on them.
Right, yeah. And ultimately, the movie comes down... I don't think the movie passes judgment on the spouses in the end. Things happen. People fall in love. And mm-hmm. It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the pacing of the movie. Wong Kar-wai has a very specific, identifiable style, and I'm wondering how it serves the film.
So there's not many real plot points in the movie, but at the same time, all the scenes are brief. And then once we've established our main characters, the director always puts like one small element to push the relationship forward. And it's these small, tiny little things. You got to look for them. And it keeps it so interesting. Sometimes it's a glance and, you know, sometimes it's a brush of the hand. But it's so nuanced, but you can feel that growing tension. And that just ramps up the pace. It keeps the pace going so well in this movie. You're, like, hypersensitive to everything that happens towards the end of the movie.
Yeah.
I was wondering if, what's the name of that Polish director who did the Three Colors
movies?
Oh,
I can never pronounce his name.
I don't know. The movie kept making me think of Red, especially, which is another sort of romance movie that isn't really a romance. But particularly the way in Red and in this movie, like repetitive shots are used, but it's not just, like, a flashback. It's going back to the exact same spot, and we understand it's a new point in time, and the movie, like, stories move forward and they have different meanings. So if we keep going back to the office clock or to the alley that's on the way to the noodles, like, there's some sense of time moving that doesn't require having new stuff happen all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah. And since the movie is partially about time, it makes sense that, I mean, and the film to me never feels slow. It is about moments in time. And indeed, we even see there are a lot of insert shots of a clock, and as Emma mentioned. The pacing of the film definitely calls attention to itself, and I think that's definitely very intentional. We're meant to luxuriate in specific moments and really enjoy it, but we're also very aware that time is ticking away. We're aware of that you know, these we are watching a series of like fleeting moments, mm-hmm. essentially. So Emma, you mentioned Red, which I believe came out before In the Mood for Love, right? That's 90s? Yeah. Were there any other stylistic influences that you noticed?
I'm not sure. It mostly made me think of other movies that I think were influenced by this one.
Yeah.
Like, I could not think of Lost in Translation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I did read that the director based the main character off of Jimmy Stewart in Vertigo,
yeah.
which I thought was very interesting because I never would have made that connection
yeah.
until I read that.
Yes. I read that as well on the esteemed web resource Wikipedia.
Mm-hmm.
And that just struck me as very strange. I guess, yeah, Wong Kar-wai based Mr. Chow on Scotty from Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
And that... now that I've read that, I can't see Mr. Chow in the same light anymore, because initially when I watched the film, I definitely took note of how Mrs. Chan seems to immediately trust Mr. Chow, and they walk down empty, dark corridors and streets together. And that struck me as strange.
Mm-hmm.
But I never got the sense that she was in any real danger with him. He always seemed like a very trustworthy guy. And while he seems unhappy and lonely, I never got the impression that he was manipulating her or projecting anything onto her that wasn't there. But after reading that, I'm wondering if maybe that was wrong. Maybe he's looking for something that isn't there.
There's a lot of ambiguity in this film, but that is probably the most ambiguous thing. I know that he described it as, you know, a man who has a trustworthy face, similar to Jimmy Stewart,
right.
but underneath that has a very darker personality.
Yeah, I didn't get a lot of darkness from his character. Now, mm-hmm. I watched the sequel. I guess we can call it a sequel. I don't know if it's officially a sequel, but there are definitely traces of darkness in the character in the follow-up 2046. But in The Mood for Love, I mean, it sort of shatters the movie if he's a dark character. I think the point is that they're both just humans, and they're lonely and trying to do the right thing, and that it's about the struggle to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
maybe just the tailoring was mostly based on Jimmy.
Yeah,
Stewart.
Yeah, it could be all the hair gel.
I thought of another movie that takes a lot of from the visual style,
yeah.
The Double, directed
okay.
by Richard Ayoade, which is on Netflix, and I recommend it.
Okay. I mean, as I was watching the movie, I immediately thought of Douglas Sirk, kind of All That Heaven Allows, just melodrama and the time frame, and you've got a disaffected housewife, even though she's not really a housewife in this movie. You've got bold colors and filtered lights, and it just really seemed heavily influenced by Douglas Sirk. And I feel like there was something with the cinematographer Christopher Doyle where he mentioned the work of Edward Hopper as an influence, which is not cinema, it's just art, but
kind
that makes sense.
The way a lot of things, we look through a lot of glasses and mirrors and things like that in this movie, makes me think of Hopper, because he always has these kind of like confined spaces, like he painted a lot of women looking like kind of trapped and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
And the colors are,
yeah,
obviously.
Exactly, yeah. And also, I love everything about this film seems to fit cohesively, like everything, the bold colors, the acting, the editing, it all seems to really emphasize, seems to highlight all the themes, and in particular, the sense of confinement, of claustrophobia. Every frame, basically, that Maggie Cheung is in is crowded. She looks confined in every frame. We've got crowded hallways, and even her dresses are apparently very restricting. Mm-hmm. So, and if in case that wasn't subtle enough, like he even films her with bars behind her and through bars, so it's like she's imprisoned. Someone's got to hate this movie, but I don't know if there anyone that person exists.
I haven't met any.
Yeah, everybody likes this movie. So what do we think about the ending? In the end, Mr. Chow leaves for Singapore, and then he's on assignment in Cambodia. And while in Cambodia, he goes to Angkor Wat and whispers a secret into a hole in the temple and covers it in mud. Was that a satisfying ending for you guys? What did you think?
I think I was satisfied by the ending. I feel like this is a movie where I would hope that people come away with it with different opinions of what it means. But my takeaway from it was that it's showing two different paths to dealing with the grief of the lost opportunity. So Sue has a child that fills her emptiness and loneliness, while Chow is resting as hard as he can on his nobility to push him forward without realizing what he's lost. So it's kind of like the consequence of being inactive versus proactive in your own life for the sake of conformity. So in this case, adhering to a code of morality that works against them. So telling the secret to the whole, like he does at the end, he can't deal with his own regret. So he allows an inanimate object to take his problems away for him.
Am I misremembering or imagining that the hole sprouts something, or are they cut to another hole that has a plant growing
out of
it?
There's some kind of plant in there, but I wasn't sure.
I felt like it was just he took a bit of grass and mud from the ground and just put it in the hole.
Yeah.
You don't think it's like maybe like there's something that can grow?
Yeah, there's a seedling or something.
Yeah.
I imagine that plant would be like the radioactive vegetables that grow in a like toxic waste dump or something. Like the nothing good can come from that secret. Or
but it was grown by love.
That's true. It was grown by repression. But Emma's a romantic, so there you go.
No, I think that's a valid take on it. Maybe it's showing that you can't hide those secrets. It will grow and it will reach out and come back in some way, shape, or form.
That's lovely.
Being in like a, you know, old monument like that too, it's like you can't see that without thinking of like all the people who've over hundreds and hundreds of years also walked there and maybe probably also whispered about the girlfriend that got away into the holes. So, you know, like this is he's not alone and there's connection to.
Yeah.
It's just like the human condition.
Yeah. Well, final question. Do you feel that this movie is worthy of the 24th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics poll? Kevin, how about we start with you?
I have my own top 100 lists of movies, greatest movies of all time. I don't think it would show up on mine, but...
Okay. You've been nothing but just glowing.
Yes.
With
very,
you
very
know,
positive.
Like, yeah.
I do think it belongs on this list. Maybe not quite so high, but yeah, absolutely. I think if I'm not mistaken, this and only one other film from the 2000s are on the list. Is that correct? Mulholland Drive, I think, is the other
one. Mulholland Drive is on the list, but Melancholia is on the list.
Oh,
Wally's on the list. There are a number of things.
Okay. Uncle Boonmi
yes,
from the 2000s.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so there's a few. I'd say in the past 20 years, there are a few films that match the caliber of this one. So, absolutely, I think it deserves a spot on the list. Maybe in the 50s somewhere like that. Let's go with that.
Is your reticence to put it at the 24th spot just because it's so new?
I think it might be.
Yeah.
I think it might be. I mean, it's tough to reflect on a movie that's fairly new. I mean, it's what, like 13 years old now,
right.
Something like that. But I mean, all the elements are so strong. I mean, visual score, acting, writing, pacing. The only weak component, and this, of course, coming from me because I'm an editor, there were some scenes that I felt like he couldn't get out of well, so he just faded away.
Okay.
He just faded out to the next scene. But other than that, I mean, everything is so powerful.
Emma, how about you?
Well, if we took the rules of the game out in number three.
Indeed. Yeah. We're going to move a whole bunch of things up.
Yeah. No, I think it's a fine place for it.
Yeah.
I do think that the last decade, though, of movies has been really awesome, and there's probably room for a lot of... Well, I don't know, though. If we think the whole history of film, it's probably got an accurate percentage or whatever. But, yeah, I think it's a good place.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah, I mean, it's really... This has been one of the more challenging things for me to rank. I say this every time, but it's a futile exercise. It's a ridiculous exercise. That being said, we're going to do it anyway. 24 seems high just because cinema is, 120 years old at this point. There have been a lot of movies. It seems strange to put one that came out 13, 14 years ago on the list. Up, like, it seems like we haven't had time to really establish its influence, which I think is a huge part of when we're trying to build a canon. I think that the film's influence should play an enormous role in determining how important something is. That being said, I do think this is one of the best films that have come out in the last 20 years. And 24, I might put it a little lower, but
it's kind of funny because it's like, it's not like the top five movies of all time. You're like, I don't know, is it the top 20 to 30th?
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, not being a film historian, do you think that maybe it is very influential on the 2000s? It seems like there's a lot of very visually stunning, independent, often non-English language movies with more ambiguity and experimental pacing and stuff like that in
absolutely.
The 2000s.
The movie feels classic, and yet it also feels really modern.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to assess where exactly it belongs. I don't think we need to think too hard about it, to be honest. It's a great movie, and everybody should watch it if you haven't
absolutely.
Already. So, all right. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Kevin is the host of his own podcast, Guilty Film. So today we're doing a bit of cross-podination, if you will.
Ha ha ha.
Har, har, har. We're going to talk about cinematic guilty pleasures. What exactly constitutes a guilty pleasure, and where do these feelings of guilt come from? And rest assured, we will make sure to provide several embarrassing examples of terrible movies that we secretly love. So, Kevin, describe your podcast and tell us why you decided to focus on guilty pleasures.
Okay, so the Guilty Film Podcast, each episode we review one of our favorite cinematic guilty pleasures. And then following that, we usually have something we call the Stable of Lawyers, where we take the criminals of the film world, I guess, and we take them to court. We usually have a specific topic for the week, and we also deal with anti-guilty pleasures, which are movies that we hate that everybody loves. But the reason we decided to focus on guilty pleasures, I guess it started because my co-host Andrew and I, we wanted to go to bat for movies that we felt were underappreciated, I guess. Or maybe rather explain to people why we like those movies, because oftentimes there are solid reasons as to why they are considered bad, quote-unquote, movies.
Yeah.
And I think oftentimes you can get very introspective looking at any movie, I guess, but especially guilty pleasures. And, you know, you ask yourself, why do I like this film? In which my brain is telling me it's a pile of crap, but my heart loves so dearly. And it affords us an opportunity to open ourselves to movies we normally wouldn't give a second thought to. And we also get to make fun of each other a lot, so that's fun too.
I mean, when we think of, I don't even know what a guilty pleasure is anymore, to be honest. Why do you think we're just... Is it about feeling ashamed for liking certain movies or certain things, certain pop cultural artifacts, or why are we meant to feel guilty about liking something?
I think the phrase itself is kind of antiquated. I don't know that it holds the same meaning that it used to. It's almost a categorization now. it's something you feel in your gut. I mean, that because we've looked into this a lot in many of our episodes, because I don't think any of us really feel guilty about the movies we talk about. We take pride in the fact that we like it and we want to share it with other people. So I think a lot of people make that decision on their own. So it's about conformity to a degree, I think, with a lot of other people. And, you know, people are thinking, what's everybody else going to like? Maybe I should like that stuff too. But I think that's changing. I think people are starting to take pride in what they like.
Yeah, yeah. And also, I think that there's been this push toward cultural relativism and just fragmentation of the marketplace. And also, there is no real cultural hegemony anymore, where I think there used to be. When you had nothing but newspaper, you had to get your criticism from, like, film journals or music journals or whatever your art form of choice would have been. But now with the internet, everyone can say what they want. And there are a lot of intelligent voices saying, hey, I really like this really nerdy thing or this really, I don't know, silly thing or whatever it is. And so there's nobody left to tell everyone else that their tastes are bad.
Well, Disney's definitely not going to tell us that. Right. I mean, like, they must be, like, delighted that, and it seems to, like, encourage, they, like, it's like a dream come true that not only kids but adults will like the Avengers and Frozen and just, like, keep buying stuff.
Right, right,
and
yeah.
And seeing all the movies.
So, basically, you're saying, like, in years past, adults would have felt some kind of shame for liking what is essentially a kid's movie. But with the rise of geek culture, and adults no longer seem to feel that shame.
Yeah, and in that way, I would argue that there is a cultural hegemony and that we're very willingly participating in it. That being said, I have a lot of Disney movies on DVD.
That's also an interesting thought. Like, the general push towards extended adolescence has removed a lot of the guilt in just indulging in our youthful pleasures. So we no longer need to feel guilty about liking the things that we liked when we were younger, whereas before there might have been a push to grow up and like more adult things, quote unquote adult things. We no longer feel that push, that pull anymore. So that could also be a huge part of it. Do you think that's a good thing, though? It's sort of a mixed bag.
Yeah, it is a mixed bag.
Well, I mean, isn't that what adults want, is to remain children for the rest of their lives?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody wants to be, you know, take up responsibility. But so it's kind of a form of escapism, I think.
Yeah.
And now that it's fully accepted, then, you know, why not?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, but as a result, we have no more. The guilt, as you say, the term guilty pleasure, the idea of a guilty pleasure has become antiquated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would like to play devil's advocate a little bit because so with the rise of like individualism and everybody being a unique snowflake and all that stuff, I think we pushed a lot towards everyone's taste being equally valid.
Yeah.
I don't know that I actually feel that way.
Okay. Good.
Because it depends on how they're presented. I mean, on our podcast, everybody's opinion is valid as long as you back it up. So that's one thing that I don't like about the internet is, you know, you can throw your opinion on there, but 99% of the time, nobody's saying why they have that opinion. It's just their opinion.
Yeah.
So that's why we break stuff down in our podcast. We talk about why. I mean, one of my guilty pleasures that we did on the podcast was the Care Bears movie. And everybody on the panel that day was like, how in the world do you like the Care Bears movie? And I had to think about it. I had to go into my brain and be like, well, this and this I liked about it. And a lot of it was nostalgia. But you got to lay it out there because I can't just say I love the Care Bears movie and not give you a reason why. And that's it.
Yeah. But I think you can because I think so much of it is nostalgia. Because I don't think I need to defend why I like The Mighty Ducks because I know it's not a good movie.
You might have to defend that opinion.
Well, I'm certainly not going to argue that it's a good movie. Do you care? Would you like to disagree? Is Mighty Ducks actually a masterpiece?
No, you're right.
I guess what I'm saying is that you need to help me understand why
Yeah.
You like it. And if that reason is nostalgia, then, you know, I can't fault you for that because I like the Care Bears movie.
Yeah. But I think that is part of, again, like the extending of adolescence. Like we now have access to the Care Bears movie or the Big Green or whatever. Take your childhood Disney movie of choice. But
no one likes the Big Green more than Mighty Ducks.
That's true. The Little Giants, the ultimate. Am I right? When are you doing The Little Giants on your podcast?
I guess soon. I want to join the panel for that?
Yeah.
I do think that getting back to the point about everybody's opinion being equally valid, I think when you say that it tends to kill any actual conversation about a movie. And that's the point of this podcast and my podcast, because we want to have varying opinions and we want to debate them, and you know,
yeah, you're right.
That's an intellectual conversation,
right? Absolutely. Yeah
I appreciate that you get to defend the movies and say what you do like about them in your podcast, because I think, you know, I'd rather see a lot of bad movies that seem bad to me trying to do something that works instead of seeing everything that doesn't work in a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we tend to take more of a positive approach, but, you know, we have our fun looking at it in a negative light as well. I mean, you know, it's fun to make fun of movies, but at the same time, we all love movies, so.
Yeah. I mean, a guilty pleasure to me is a movie that on some level I know is not a great movie, and yet I enjoy it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about? I feel like people love talking about not great movies.
Sure.
And do you guys focus on both the good and bad elements of every movie?
Mm-hmm.
Which do you enjoy talking about more, the good or the bad elements?
You know, it's at different times it's been fun talking about both. I mean, we did an episode on Sister Act where we almost had all good things to say about the movie. Because it's just a fun movie. Like, everybody loves Sister Act. And that was a great episode. But then we've done episodes on Call the Conqueror, which was a Kevin Sorbo barbarian movie. And, you know, we trashed it, but we had fun. And that was my guilty pleasure, and I had fun trashing the movie, too. Because I think a lot of it comes down to you look at a movie and you ask, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
And it's just this interesting look at what could have gone through the filmmaker's mind when they were doing this. It's like you're trying to figure them out, like it's a puzzle you're trying to put together. And you know that you'll never have the real answer, but it's fun to postulate what may have been going on.
Right. It's disturbing to me to think that people are having more fun and enjoying bad movies more than they're enjoying good movies. I think there's, in some ways, there's more fun to be had in watching a bad movie than there is in a good movie. I also think that this push towards the juvenilization of our culture has sort of led to, I'd say, like, not an ostracization, but there's this feeling of isolation with people who aren't super into bad movies, or I don't want to put that judgment on. What's another word for bad movie? I don't want, like, something less judgmental, sort of
popcorn flick.
Yeah something sort of brainless movies.
And
as someone who created a podcast just so she could talk about quote-unquote good movies, there's something troubling to me about this push toward focusing more on pop culture movies.
I think the answer is actually pretty easy to come to, and that's that it's difficult to break down a good film, and it's easy to break down a bad film.
That's true, yeah.
There's simplicity to it, and that's why, you know, 95% of the movie podcasts out there are about bad films.
Yeah.
I guess mine included, because we don't want to have to think too much.
Yeah.
But I think that there should be equal conversation about all movies.
Yeah.
That's why I'm enjoying myself so much on this podcast.
Oh, good. Yeah. I mean, your podcast doesn't focus exclusively on bad movies like many other podcasts do. You know,
right. Yeah. We're not seeking out bad movies. We're seeking out movies that we love regardless of whether or not they're perceived as good or bad, but typically they're perceived as bad.
Yeah. Another element of guilty pleasures. I very rarely feel guilty for liking anything. But I think that gender can play a role in whether a person likes or dislikes a movie. I think men in particular feel a certain pressure to dislike things that are perceived to be girly. And I'm wondering if you guys have ever addressed that on your podcast.
Yeah, we probably have. We've done a number of romantic comedies, and that is usually an issue that comes up. I guess I can only speak for men. So I would imagine that females would find less shame and fault in movies that resonate with them more. So we've done a movie like The Proposal with Sandra Bullock and Ryan Reynolds, which is targeted, obviously, towards the female demographic, right? So not that I liked that film at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you that my co-host Andrew didn't like that film.
Why didn't you like it?
It just isn't for me. I mean, it wasn't targeted for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, that's just – the studio knows that going in. So – but there are certainly romantic comedies, movies that are geared towards females that I like, and I don't feel any shame. But I have a feeling that a typical male would.
Yeah.
That it's – and I guess that just has to do with men not being comfortable being feminized, I guess, by saying that they like that kind of stuff.
Right.
Because I love Kate and Leopold.
Okay.
Which I don't know if you guys have seen that one.
I have seen that
one. It's a great movie.
Long time ago.
But I don't feel bad for that at all.
Okay.
I think it has to do with the individual, how comfortable they are saying, yeah, I like that, even though it was made for women.
Yeah. But, and you don't, I think that's a pretty bold statement for you to just come out and say that you like Kate and Leopold, to be honest. Does it feel good to let that off your chest, you know?
I think that's nothing that I would hide. I also like Dirty Dancing Havana Nights.
Well, that's just embarrassing.
But see, and yet I feel no shame.
Good.
I've been doing guilty film for a while, so I'm used to admitting to these things.
Good.
This isn't totally related, but sometimes I do feel guilty about liking movies that have some element that one might call problematic.
Yes.
It's a very popular thing now, too, is calling out movies on being problematic, meaning either sexist or racist or transphobic or somehow exclusive or offensive to somebody.
Exactly.
Which I think is important work to do, but like the Dallas Buyers Club, I really liked that movie, and I really liked Jared Leto in it. I definitely agree with, like, people saying that that could have easily gone to a transgendered actress.
Yep.
And, like, it is, like, totally unfair to, like, if you're, say, a transgendered teenager, sit at home and watch Jared Leto get an Oscar saying, like, for, you know, putting on a dress and pretending to be a lady.
Right. Yeah.
So, like, I don't think anyone would say that's a bad movie, but I do feel like some hint of guilt in watching something like that.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up because that is the one area where I still feel some guilt when I like something that is so clearly problematic. This movie comes up a lot on this podcast, Gone with the Wind. I love Gone with the Wind. But it is unquestionably a terribly, terribly racist movie. And I'm still trying to reconcile my love for parts of that movie with my just horror at other parts. So I'm still trying to somehow justify how much I love that movie.
Yeah, like I definitely feel way guiltier about watching something and enjoying it and not being able to justify why I like it than like to watch a superhero movie. Like I love James Bond, but I can't justify anything that movie is about, except that I used to watch it when I was a kid and he shoots things. It's fun. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's certainly a place for movies that are just there to entertain. My concern is that becomes the exclusive. That's just those movies seem to have taken over our culture in the way that once the cultural phenomenons used to be romantic comedies and so-called adult movies. And there's been a lot of talk about this in in many thing pieces and stuff like that. And there's no real answer. I think, you know, cultural tides ebb and flow. And we're just at this point, there is this push towards indulging our inner child. So, I don't know. I'm glad that we don't have to feel guilty about liking what we like. And I am as snobby as they come. So I do sort of feel a sense of I do sort of feel left out of the culture because there is so much emphasis on superhero and action and stuff like that. And just generally, even the comedy seems very adolescent in some ways. In other ways, I think we're growing and maturing as humans. But in other facets of pop culture, like music, for instance, I'm glad that I no longer need to feel embarrassed for saying I like Taylor Swift. You know, I can just come out and say it.
Mm-hmm. You're out. You've admitted it.
Exactly. and in that sense, I'm really glad. But I don't know. For me, I don't know why I don't apply the same cultural relativism to movies as I do to other art forms. And at the same time, there is terrific stuff on streaming devices. I'm still trying to figure out what to call it. It's not really television, but you watch it on your TV. But
digital television.
Yeah,
content.
Yeah. so I think. Yeah, that's another area where there is such a sharp division between good programming and not good programming. Mm-hmm. Like, there's television that will indulge you and show you fancy houses and nice food and crazy housewives, and then there's the really thoughtful stuff about families and societal ills and all manner of different interesting things. So, I suppose there's a place for both, and they're both interesting to talk about, so. All right, that's enough shaming for one show. It's time for us to give full-throated endorsements to a piece of pop culture that we've been digging lately. Emma, let's start with you.
Oh, yes, let's start with me. Yes. So many things, but out of all of them, I downloaded an app for my phone recently, 123D Catch. And what it allows you to do is make 3D photograms on your iPhone using the in-phone camera. So you just basically take a bunch of pictures of a can of soup or yourself or a building or what have you, and it parses them together and makes a little creepy 3D model of it. And you can share them online and look at ones that other people have made. It breaks down sometimes, at least on my phone. I've got a 5C, I want to say. But it works pretty good, and it's pretty amazing.
All right. Future is now.
And it's free.
Yeah, even better.
Oh, it's the best.
Kevin, how about you?
So there is a TV show that's been on for a little while, and I think it has a pretty good following, but nobody that I know watches it, so I'm going to try to spread the word a little more. On BBC America, there's a show called Orphan Black, which is a sci-fi drama, and it's mostly about human cloning. And if anything, you should watch that show to see the main star, Tatiana Maslany, who is a Canadian actress that I had never seen prior to the show. But she is something to behold. She plays, I think, 8 or 9 different versions of herself at this point, all different, all with varying accents. She is amazing. So that's alone. It's worth watching Orphan Black just for her.
Yes. That is a very popular. I'm surprised you don't know people who watch that show.
I know not a single person that watches it, but
that
me.
That is very strange. I think if you put that out on your podcast, you will get lots of responses from people who love that show.
Okay.
Yeah. mine is about, 2014 was undoubtedly a great year for what I'm going to call Big Sister Lit. I don't know if it has an actual category or if I just made that up or what, but there were several books and memoirs that came out from lots of really intelligent women that were offering up their stories as either cautionary tales or inspirational tales. Lena Dunham had Not That Kind of Girl. Roxane Gay had Bad Feminist. Kathleen Moran, How to Build a Girl. Amy Poehler had Yes, Please. And I greatly admire all of those women. And I feel very fortunate to live in a world where they get to, where the marketplace is saturated with all these great female voices. But I've also recently been on a kick to go revisit female humorists of the past. And my most recent, my most recent exploration is the work of Fran Lebowitz, who I remember watching as a kid on Charlie Rose. And first of all, thinking that she was just so striking. She has this very distinct look about her and very distinct voice. And I remember her always talking about how she could never bring herself to write anything. So I always assumed that there was nothing of her that I could actually read. But I recently found out that that is, in fact, not true, and that there is a collection of her essays and her articles from that, most of which were written in the 70s, late 70s, called Metropolitan Life. And while some of her jokes are pretty dated, like she mocks the women's lib movement for being humorless, she's also a really great writer. And I do have a quote that I just thought I would share. I was in Rome for about 2 weeks, during which time there were 5 major strikes. I don't know what the strikers wanted or whether or not they got it, but it probably didn't matter. Going on strike in Rome is much more a matter of style than it is of economics. Rome is a very loony city in every respect. One needs but spend an hour or two there to realize that Fellini makes documentaries. Felt like that was an apt quote for this podcast. But while there has been this cultural shift in the last 30-something years that's emphasized positivity and sincerity over cynicism, the cultural shift is really, really highlighted or really like put into stark relief in her work, because she's pretty abrasive, but in a really delightful way. Now women couch words of wisdom and advice and clever jokes and stories, whereas Fran uses kind of a faux advice column to couch just hilarious insults. And in the end, I'm glad that the cultural tides have turned. As we discussed in our previous segment, a lot has changed in the last 30 years. But I also feel very fortunate to be able to go back and revisit that mean-spirited energy of years past. And that's the way we frame it, flicks-wise, that is. If our listeners have any guilty pleasures that they'd like to disclose, the comments section of our website, flickswise.com, is a very safe place to do so. And I'm hereby declaring our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise, to be a judgment-free zone, so confess away. You can also message me on Twitter at flickswise. But before you do all of that, please rate us and leave us a comment on iTunes. On our next show, we're going to talk about a movie that's tied within The Mood for Love on the Sight and Sound list, Carl Theodore Dreyer's Odette. We hope you'll join us for that. Until then, Kevin, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And Emma, pleasure as always.
Pleasure to be here.
All right, until we meet again.